This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today, some of our favorite conversations about books from this year. In particular, books written by and for strong women. From how women appear in myth and legend.
We think, who are the gossips? How are they gendered? We always think of them as women. And we think of gossip as something that is cruel rather than a possible strategy for finding solidarity among like-minded folks. All of those ways of not just silencing women, but discrediting what they have to say.
To perceptions of women in the workplace, including their experiences of sexual harassment at work and beyond.
It's something that we should realize is happening to our friends, our colleagues at work, people in our families, and that we should really look at it from the point of view of those individuals who have had the experiences.
But first, the remarkable and complicated story of Annie Cohen Kupchovsky, a Latvian immigrant living in Boston's West End. She was a wife and a mother of three. But if you were around in the mid-1890s, you probably would have known her as Annie Londonderry, the 23-year-old who this week in 1894 began an extraordinary journey around the world on a bicycle. One part P.T. Barnum, one part Susan B. Anthony, with a whole lot of Nellie Bly, her story captured the zeitgeist of the times, the women's suffrage movement, extraordinary tales told in newspapers, and of course, a healthy dose of snake oil. Londonderry is at the center of the story in a book by local author Peter Zoytlin. His new book is Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. We spoke with Peter this summer about the book and started by asking him to describe who Annie Londonderry was.
She was this young mother, married in her late teens with three young kids by the time she was about 23 years old, living in this tenement in the West End, not particularly happy with her life and looking for a means of escape. And she found it on a bicycle.
So tell us what her life would have been.
Her life would have been more of the same, pretty much drudgery. You know, she once told her granddaughter she didn't want to have another child under her apron every year. She was cleaning, she was shopping, she was cooking, she was actually working outside the home as an advertising solicitor for the Boston newspapers. But living in the West End, she was exposed to people from all corners of the world. It was one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the United States at the time. And I think for anyone with an imagination that took them beyond the banks of the Charles River, it was a community that would have inspired some curiosity about the world outside the one she was living in.
You know, when I first heard about her, I was like, I'm sorry, what? A woman in the late 1890s biked across the world. Now, and then I find out she'd never even been on a bike before this big wager. Reading the book, I came to a new appreciation also of the role of the bicycle, the history of bicycle for Boston, for women's suffrage, for women's rights. I had no idea there was an intersection there. Tell us.
Yes, I think this is one of the most underappreciated pieces of history about the women's movement of the time, is how vital the bicycle was in transforming the lives of women who were seeking the vote and seeking social equality. It gave them new mobility. It gave them the exhilaration of freedom of movement. But it wasn't without controversy. A lot of people thought it was absolutely, you know, inappropriate for women to be exerting themselves on a bicycle or showing too much leg, for example. And Susan B. Anthony, actually have her quote on the cover of the book. She said, "Bicycling has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It changed the way women dressed because they had to adapt their clothing, as Annie did, to the practicalities of cycling. And it was really, getting on a bicycle was a woman's declaration of independence."
So, you know, she pushed her independence in a lot of ways by taking this supposed, and I understand from you, it is a supposed wager. So let's just talk about that for a minute. What started her on a bicycle trip around the world?
Well, the story is it was reported all over the world. And I should say she left a trail of newspaper coverage everywhere she went. I've collected thousands of articles about her. And it's consistently reported that two wealthy Boston merchants were debating one of the major issues of the day, which is women's equality. And the bet was, could a woman do what only a man had done before, which was to circle the world on a bicycle? And why a bicycle? Because bicycling had become such a popular pastime, and women were coming into the sport as bicycles became, they evolved from those high wheelers into the bicycles that look like the ones we ride today. So it was a debate over women's rights. And those who are old enough to remember, this was sort of an early version of the tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. and the wager had certain conditions. The woman who made the trip had to do it in 15 months, had to cover 10,000 miles by bicycle, and had to earn the impressive sum of $5,000 en route, starting without a penny in her pocket. So the notion here was, this isn't just going to be a test of a woman's physical endurance and mental fortitude. It's going to be a test of a woman's ability to fend for herself in the world.
You're listening to Radio Boston. We're talking with author Peter Zeutlin about his book Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story of Annie Londonderry making a bicycle trip around the world. You said a minute ago, Peter, that she left a trail of newspaper coverage, so people all around the world knew about her, but you came to know about her in a more personal way, right? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, oddly enough, this story was completely unknown to anyone in my family that I knew. This woman was my great-grandaunt, my great-grandfather's sister. My mother and I learned about her in 1993 when we got a letter from a complete stranger who said he was researching the story of the first woman to bike around the world. And he had done a little bit of genealogy research and thought my mother might be a descendant. And it was clear from the connections he made in the letter that he'd found the right family. But my mother had never heard of Annie, never heard of the bike trip. And, over the next several years, I would ask every family member I could think of, who is this woman? Do you know anything about a bike trip? Nothing. Everybody came up completely empty, completely unknown within my own family.
So, I'm struck by that because part of the conceit of the book, the voice in the book is Annie. She's writing. Mm-hmm. She's writing to her granddaughter, Mary, explaining her life. And let's just bring that home, actually, for our listeners. I'm going to ask you to read a bit from the book. It's early on page 12. You want to go ahead and read?
Yeah. And I'll just say that Mary is Annie's only direct living descendant, her only grandchild, who's now 89 years old. And she writes to her, "Let's be honest. I wasn't a good mother, and I've tried as a kind of restitution, I suppose, to be a good grandmother to you, my only grandchild. I mean, what kind of mother leaves three young children and a husband behind to go gallivanting around the world on a bicycle? I was supposed to love my babies, but I felt, to be frank, detached from them. All the women around me spoke of the maternal instinct, but I didn't have a nurturing bone in my body. I didn't neglect them. Well, not until I got on that bicycle, and they were always well-fed and had clean clothes to wear. I have my regrets now, but that's water over the dam. I've never been given much to introspection or looking back, and I still think psychiatry is a bunch of hooey. But it's a fair question you might have. Why was I so distant from my own children? How could I leave them behind for a lark around the world on a wheel? Why didn't I have the maternal instinct almost all women around me did?"
That's author Peter Zeutlin reading from his new book, Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. It's interesting. She hid her identity when she left, in part, as the book argues, because for people to rally behind her, being a young mother who'd left her children behind was not an attractive headline. Being Jewish in America was not an attractive headline. She was controversial.
Yes. She completely reinvented herself as someone else along the way. And it was almost never mentioned in the press, because she didn't tell anyone, that she had children and that she was married. there was one small item in the New York World newspaper about a month after she left. That's when I learned that this woman who'd gone around the world left three children behind. It was utterly startling to me, but also gave me hope because I realized if those children had children, I might be able to find a distant relative who could shed light on this mystery woman. So she did that very sort of archetypical American thing. She reinvented herself completely as a different person. And the name Londonderry, which helped conceal her Jewish heritage, also had a commercial purpose because she was the first, at least the first woman I can find, who took endorsements. Londonderry was the spring water company based up in New Hampshire. And they were her first corporate sponsor, and she carried a placard on her bike with their logo on it. So she was pioneering sports-related marketing for women, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of the book, she's basically like a NASCAR driver. She's wearing ribbons all over, and I mean, her whole body's covered in advertising.
Yeah, well, she had a background in advertising, and she realized, I have to earn $5,000. And the more famous she became, the more advertisers in different cities clamored to rent space on her back or her body or her, and she had like a rate card, depending on what part of her body you wanted to stitch your advertisement to, you paid a greater fee or a lesser fee. And so she was quite a spectacle. And, you know, she understood then the way the captains of Silicon Valley understand now, that attention equaled money. So she was all about becoming as big a spectacle as she could be. She didn't run away to join the circus. She became the circus. You know, she traveled with a pearl-handled revolver. She eventually, for most of the trip, was riding a man's bicycle in men's clothing. She's covered in advertising, and she's out there spinning fantastic tales of danger and adventure, which is why the book is based on a mostly true story, because what I learned researching her story the first time when I wrote the nonfiction version is that the true story of Annie Londonderry includes a laundry list of fabrications, stories she told about her own background and stories
about
the places
she lied all the time.
I
recognize she was a relative of yours, but let's just say it. She lied all the time.
I thought my job initially was going to be to prove her purchase on the title of First Woman Around the World by Bicycle. And there became a point when it was obvious to me the stories weren't adding up. But then it dawned on me, you know, I've got a more interesting character to wrestle with here than I initially thought. You know, one of the things she loved to tell reporters in her eagerness to, you know, have them spill ink about her, she often said that she was a Harvard medical student. And I was naive. I actually called the registrar's office at Harvard. And they told me, we didn't admit women to Harvard Medical School until the 1940s.
And this was 1894, 1895.
This was 1895. She had a very casual relationship with the truth. But it kind of.
So I'm going to stop you there for a second, just because we have limited time, and I want to pick that up. Mm-hmm. We are in a moment where there's a lot of question about the value of truth, especially truth in the media, truth in politicians, truth in public figures. Mm-hmm. Did you think there'd be a particular resonance here?
You know, I didn't really think about that, but except in retrospect, I thought, you know, she was kind of not the original, she wasn't the only purveyor of fake news. You have to remember that this was the era of what was called yellow journalism. This was this over-the-top, sensational journalism that the very competitive papers, particularly in New York, engaged in an attempt to attract readers. You know, the New York World, Pulitzer's flagship paper, for which she wrote her first-person account of this trip, was what you would get if the New York Times had acquired the National Enquirer. You know, kind of a mashup of over-the-top sensation and serious news at the same time. And she was very astute. She had a very modern sense of celebrity. I you know, if she was alive today, she'd be an Instagram influencer with like 10 million followers. She really knew how to use the tools at her disposal, which were very limited, you know, the Telegraph and the newspapers, to transform herself from this anonymous working mother from Boston into a global celebrity, albeit for a short time.
Local author Peter Zeutlin there talking about his book Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. Stay with us. Coming up, one woman's 30-year journey to end gender-based violence, Professor Anita Hill. That's after the break. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is a special hour of Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and today we are revisiting some of our favorite conversations from this year about books, and in particular, books authored by and for strong women. Before the break, we brought you the story of Annie Londonderry, the West End immigrant who rode her bicycle out of town and around the world. Now we turn to a modern powerhouse. And just a warning, folks, this conversation contains descriptions of sexual harassment and assault. Some of you may remember this.
Apart from the assault itself, these past couple of weeks have been the hardest of my life. I've had to relive this trauma in front of the world.
Or perhaps this.
Telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life. But it is very close to having to live through the experience that occasioned this meeting.
That was Christine Blasey Ford, followed by Anita Hill, both testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, but 27 years apart. They alleged sexual assault and sexual harassment by Supreme Court nominees. Anita Hill, now a professor of social policy, law, and women's gender and sexuality studies at Brandeis University, published a book in 2021 reflecting on progress for women, or lack thereof, in the decades since her testimony and calling for sweeping community action to end gender violence. Earlier this fall, we spoke with Professor Hill about her book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender-Based Violence. I began our conversation by asking her what led her to write this book now and what she hoped to accomplish with it.
Well, first I want to raise awareness to the urgency of the problem of gender-based violence. And I want to educate people who aren't quite aware that gender-based violence covers a range of behaviors from bullying in schools to sexual harassment in the workplace, to intimate partner violence at home, and to rape and sexual assault on the streets.
I was really struck by your choice to define all of that as violence. That strikes me as having, you know, sort of practical implications on a policy level and psychological implications as well. Clearly, you did that on purpose. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the connections between all of those things came from my experience and my testimony about sexual harassment that I had experienced and that I testified to in 1991, and then hearing from people who connected my experience with their own experience of gender-based violence, including rape and sexual assault victims, including domestic violence victims. So the connection is there. It's there in the minds of victims and survivors. And I wanted to honor their perception of what is going on in our country that we need to address.
So I want to understand that a little more. So you wanted to honor that people experience the full gamut. Obviously, we know when we're talking about rape, sexual assault, we know we are talking about violence. You wanted to honor the feeling of being violated in a violent way across that full continuum of experiences. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Oh, exactly. And I want to add, too, that even when we are talking about sexual harassment, many times people think of harassment as being verbal harassment or environmental harassment in a workplace. But when you look at the case law, as I have, you realize that many times, on many occasions, in the cases that come before the court, this physical abuse, physical groping, sexual assault, and sexual extortion happens. And it's hard, really, once you look at the range of behavior that happens even under the category of sexual harassment, to exclude that. You know, the connection is also in terms of the way the public and sometimes even friends respond to claims of gender-based violence, including harassment and including extreme cases of rape.
Is there any risk in calling, let's say, verbal sexual harassment and including it in the realm of gender-based violence? Is there any risk that that will suppress reporting, that people, you know, you talk about women who have spoken up and people of any, all genders who have spoken up being told it's not that bad. Will people self-edit, well, it wasn't violent, if we broaden that definition?
Well, people are already self-editing and they are experiencing a violation. And so I don't think that people who have experienced sexual harassment will edit themselves anymore because we are recognizing a range of behavior. In fact, I think people will feel affirmed in the recognition of the connections of all of these behaviors.
One of the things that's really striking in the book is it is full of stories. And when I mean full of stories, I mean every chapter and multiple stories in every chapter. Have you found yourself asked essentially to be a personal collection space of people's stories of gender violence for the last 30 years? And if so, how have you made your way through that? How have you carried that?
Well, the stories are essential because I think they humanize the experience. In some ways, I think people like to distance themselves from categories of behavior as though it doesn't affect them. But when you hear the stories of people who have had experiences that I've described in the book, you realize that this is a very human experience, and it's not something that we should neglect or try to distance ourselves from. It's something that we should realize is happening to our friends, our colleagues at work, people in our families, and that we should really look at it from the point of view of those individuals who have had the experiences.
The breadth and the scope of the picture that you paint, Professor Hill, is damning. It just is. I have to assume we have not progressed as you thought we might after your own experience in 1991.
In 1991, I had expected to hear from people who had experienced sexual harassment. That was my expectation. One of the very first calls that I got after the hearings, I was sitting in my office and an individual called me. I picked up the phone. I was hesitant at first because I had been getting harassing phone calls and threatening phone calls. And this individual started out to me by saying, "You've opened a whole can of worms." And this was a person who described himself as a man who had been an incest victim. And he said that the hearings and the way that the Senate approached me reminded him of the way that his parents approached him when he tried to tell them that he had been victimized. They dismissed his claim and sided with his abuser. And he was working through those issues, and hearing the Senate's treatment of me helped him to understand his parents' reaction, that it wasn't personal, that it was part of our culture. And so this is, you know, certainly not where I expected to be, but the whole can of worms is something that we all have to address. We can't just sort of parse out and deal with this as an issue that it's only related to certain people or only happens occasionally or happens because of a few bad apples. We have to look really with clear eyes at all of what is going on in the world and what we need to do to start to develop solutions to address it.
So I want to put a marker down here, which is that in our time together, I don't want to relitigate 1991. I don't want to relitigate the portions of this history that we've had 30 years to discuss and people have been discussing for 30 years. But there are a couple of pieces of new material in your book that we're getting a chance to hear from you on now, and I do want to touch on those two pieces. And the first is Christine Blasey Ford's testimony about Brett Kavanaugh. You talk about it in the book. I just want to ask you what it was like to be you watching that unfold.
Well, fortunately, the me that was watching that is not the 35-year-old who experienced the hearing of 1991. I, even in 2018, had gone through years of working through this problem, understanding the problem in the larger sense and understanding the problem in terms of how people experience it. But the hearing was different in 2018 for me. You know, clearly something that I had similar experience with. Christine Blasey Ford is her own experience. My experience in 91 is my own experience. But what was striking was that even 27 years after my hearing, there had not been a process in place for Christine Blasey Ford to come into that would allow her to be heard and to be treated fairly. And so, you know, it didn't surprise me entirely. I wasn't surprised. I hoped it would be better. I hoped it would be better in terms of the process. And I hoped it might have a different outcome. But neither of those two things happened.
I'll come back in a minute to that question of process. I do want to pick up one other event from the book. You address President Joe Biden at the end of the book, his apology to you in 2017 for how he handled your hearing. You also said you voted for him because you always ask which candidate will do the most to end gender violence. Have you ever seen a candidate for national office that you thought, this is the one, this is really the one?
Well, unfortunately, we don't ask candidates whether they are going to address this problem. And that's something that needs to be happening regularly. Not only for a president, but for all of our representatives, what are you going to do to address this problem? So I really can't judge any of the candidates because we haven't gotten there yet. We haven't even made it part of the conversation in our elections yet. And until we do, we won't really know who is the best candidate unless we know that, you know, something about where they stand on the issue.
I want to move towards solutions now. You spend some significant time in the book talking about that. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt from the introduction to Believing. Please go ahead.
The challenge of addressing gender-based violence is that the problem is complex, and any solutions will require more than technical skills. Gender-based violence is a global phenomenon. According to the United Nations Secretary General's report on violence against women, gender-based violence takes many forms: physical, sexual, psychological, and economic, that are interrelated and affect women from birth to old age. And over time, like viruses, patterns of violence evolve and new forms emerge. It drains resources from public services and employers, and reduces human capital formation, making it a business problem as well as a social problem. It can ravage survivors' health as well as thrust them into poverty. It has infiltrated politics and disrupted workforces, schools and universities, and communities all at once.
I picked that because of the scale, the scope that you are putting a stake in the ground about. What would it take to address the problem on the scale that you're arguing it exists?
Well, you know, first of all, you have to acknowledge that a problem exists. And then once you acknowledge, you invest in measuring it, because you can't fix what you haven't measured and acknowledged. And so we can start there with a leadership commitment to do this. And I'm not talking just about leaders in Washington. I'm talking about leaders in our colleges and universities, in our local school districts, in our police departments around the country. All of this leadership needs to be involved in the solution, because the problem is evident in all of those institutions.
That was Anita Hill, now a professor of social policy, law, and women's gender and sexuality studies at Brandeis University. She's the author of the book, Believing, Our 30-Year Journey to End Gender-Based Violence. Stay with us. Coming up, a look at women from myth to movies. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we have been revisiting some of our favorite conversations from this year about books, and in particular, books authored by and written for strong women. We started off the show by hearing about Annie Londonderry, the local immigrant who rode her bicycle around the world. And before the break, you heard our conversation with Anita Hill on her book about ending gender-based violence in the workplace and beyond. Let's end the hour with a look at heroines, old and new. We find strong women in story and screen today, from those with superhuman powers like Brie Larson as Captain Marvel in 2019.
I'm kind of done with you telling me what I can't do.
To more subtle incarnations like Mother Marmee March and Daughter Jo March, played by Laura Dern and Saoirse Ronan in 2019's Little Women.
You remind me of myself.
But you're never angry.
I'm angry nearly every day of my life.
You are?
I'm not patient by nature. But with nearly 40 years of effort, I'm learning to not let it get the better of me.
But for the women of myth and fairy tales, the path to heroism, not so clear. So how do we recast those ancient stories? We set out to answer that question with Maria Tatar, the author of The Heroine with 1001 Faces. She is also the chair of the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University. In this conversation from October, we started out by asking her reaction to the two clips from Little Women and Captain Marvel that you just heard.
Well, as I listened to Marty, all I could think of was Mildred Hayes. Do you remember Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri?
Frances McDormand.
Yes, absolutely. And how she uses words. She has some weapons too, and she's a woman who understands the power of violence. So she's a little unusual in that way. But the fact that she is an angry woman, she is bent on revenge. But we could also think of her as being bent on social justice, on some kind of justice for her daughter. So we have now emerging, Hollywood is giving us these new models of heroines. And on the one hand, we have the warrior woman who is kind of imitating the heroes of ancient times, seeking glory, seeking immortality through conquest and combat. But there's another model that I think harks back to the heroines of ancient times, women who use words and stories and craft to find a way to secure justice, to bend the arc of the moral universe, as it were, toward justice.
Tell us about one of those women. Give us an example from old mythology or fairy tales.
Oh, well, one of my favorite is, we could start with Philomela and then maybe talk about Scheherazade as well. Philomela is raped by, she's the victim of a sexual assault. She's raped by her brother-in-law, Tereus. And what does she do? She threatens him. She tells him that she's going to broadcast the story of what he has done to her. He responds by cutting out her tongue. And Ovid, in the Metamorphoses, Ovid, who tells us this story, describes in great detail, in excruciating detail, the tongue that is quivering on the ground. So Philomela no longer has words, but what does she do? She weaves the story of her rape into a tapestry and gives it to her sister so that the deed will come to light. Now, we could also think about the Me Too movement in this context, where stories are used to get even, in a sense, but also to change the culture in which we live today. And that's where I think Scheherazade is so important, because she is a courageous woman. She volunteers to marry Shahryar, who is killing off one wife after another the morning after. And what is her strategy? What is her weapon? She uses stories as her sword, in a way. And she tells these cliffhangers, which are so seductive and so exciting, that Shahryar decides to let her live for another night. And this continues for 1001 Nights. And then she not only survives, she saves her own neck, but she also changes the culture in which she lives, because Shahryar then decides to end his cruel, violent ways and take a different turn in his role as ruler.
So I want to say two things here. First, for our listeners, in order to have this conversation, we're going to keep hearing stories like this. It is part of what is remarkable about the myth and the fairy tale. So be aware, we are talking about sexual assault. We are talking about violence. We are talking about the muting of women and repression, and that will continue to be a part of this segment. The other thing that I want to pick up here, Maria Tatar, and then I'll go to our first call. You really struck me. You told those stories, and then at some moment in the book, you talk about the Little Mermaid and her losing her voice in order to essentially come to the surface. And that just slapped me in the face, this tradition of then muting women if they want to get what they – not even get what they – I'm never going to try to finish the sentence because you can finish it for me.
Silencing, yes, because those stories were so powerful, because they were weapons – we needed strategies to silence women. And so you can go back to the Odyssey and hear Telemachus telling his mother to be quiet and go back to her weaving, or figures like Philomela, whose tongue is cut out, or the Little Mermaid, who trades her voice. And what does she trade her voice for? But the love of a man. She really wants a soul more than anything else. So in some ways, she uses the prince also. But think about how women's talk has also been trivialized. That is, we think, who are the gossips? How are they gendered? We always think of them as women. And we think of gossip as something that is cruel rather than a possible strategy for finding solidarity among like-minded folks. Or we refer to chit-chat or chatter. All of those ways of not just silencing women, but discrediting what they have to say. The most spectacular example, of course, being Cassandra, who is able to foretell what is going to happen in the Trojan War, but nobody pays any attention to her at all because Apollo, who gave her the gift of prophecy, decided to take it back by telling her that that nothing that she said would be believed. And why does he take it back? Because she decides, she has misgivings about having an affair with him.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, just thud, right? Thud right there. That story. It so underscores your point. Courtney's on the line in Cambridge. Courtney, join the conversation.
Hi. Thank you so much. I was, I guess it never stuns me how synchronous sometimes the radio can be, especially your show. My friends rewrote the myth of Medusa and showed it in the Museum of Science last year. Projecting it onto the planetarium, Brian King and Nathan Cohen and Dennis Monagle, they all played the music for it. And then Brian King really wrote the script, I guess. I don't want to, but it is about Medusa, who was raped by Poseidon and portrays the gods discussing, how to put Athena in her place, because Athena had really overstepped her power and her boundaries. So the way they were going to put her into her place was to rape one of her goddesses. And so Poseidon went down and did his thing. And then the rewrite is about how Medusa wasn't a monster, but that Athena sent her to be at peace because she really did want to be somewhat of like, not a recluse, but just at peace. She didn't want to be involved in the human drama of victim, villain, rescuer, the social drama triangle. And so she was given the mask of Medusa to protect the land and the magic that
Courtney,
she could see.
That's such a great example. Thank you. And Courtney's example there, Maria, it's this perfect segue into one of the brain benders of the book, which is, we often talk about, well, women don't get written as the heroes. But part of the point that you're making in the book about these stories is it's not that they're not written as the heroes. It's that we don't recognize what they've done as heroic. And that's something a little different. And that is very powerful. And that reframing that Courtney was just giving us about Medusa, I feel like kind of underscores that point.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And if you think about it, in the 1980s, women writers like Anne Sexton, Angela Carter, Margaret Atwood, Toni Morrison took up folklore and fairy tales. And what did they do? They retold the stories from a different perspective. And suddenly they sort of turned them inside out and upside down. Now, in recent years, what has happened is that women writers have taken up Greek myths. They've taken up the story of the Trojan War. They've taken up the epics and told the stories from a different perspective.
Like Circe.
So you have Pat Barker, who writes The Silence of the Girls, who gives us the Trojan War from the perspective of Briseis. And suddenly we see Achilles is actually a butcher. He's a monster. He fails miserably as a hero, but Briseis has this quiet dignity. She cares for other people. She's curious about their welfare, and she manages to become heroic in that narrative. And then in many of the other works like Natalie Haynes' A Thousand Ships, or we could think of Ursula Le Guin's Lavinia would be another great example.
So I want to now pick up on another thread, and I want to bring in Game of Thrones, if you'll forgive me. And it's because at the beginning you also talked about there is this other version where we are making the women the warriors. And in reading your book, I kept thinking about Game of Thrones. Spoiler alert, folks out there, if you haven't watched the series or read the books, women are treated abominably. Then they wind up with power and control, and then largely they pay for claiming the warrior's place. And that is recent yes. popular culture.
Yes, fascinating, isn't it? And you have a whole range of figures in Game of Thrones. Now, you know, the men aren't much better, I would say,
that's
in
fair.
That particular series. So, but that's fascinating because I talked about some of the new models for heroism that are available. And I would say not just for women, but also for men. But then we have the anti-heroine who is emerging in films like Get Out, where Rose becomes a kind of Bluebeard figure from fairy tales who's killing off, or like Shahryar, who's killing off successive fiancés, or Ex Machina, where you have a robot who is, I guess, should I put in a spoiler alert?
Yeah, we're spoiling things all over the place, folks, so just go with
it. Let's put it this way. We have another anti-hero, a woman who is really to be feared, and something very different from those heroines who exercise curiosity and care in order to survive and to help others survive.
Oh, please stay with curiosity for a minute, because that was another big theme.
Oh, yes. Think of our foundational stories. Eve. Eve is seduced by the serpent. She eats fruit from the tree of knowledge. And yet we always see her as somebody who is interested in carnal knowledge. She seduces Adam, and she brings evil and sin into the world, much like Pandora, who lifts the lid of the jar given to her, and then releases plague, famine, want, labor, all of these terrible things into the world, leaving us with nothing but hope. So curiosity, this a virtue in my book, and something that we want to promote in children today as we raise children, want to promote it in ourselves, is something that is demonized, is seen as a negative trait when women possess it or exercise it. And etymologically, curiosity is actually related to care. Early usages of the term, if you go back to the 16th, 17th century, you discover that curiosity means being attentive, caring for something. And it's such a no-brainer in a way. It's totally logical, because when you are curious, you begin to care about something. And I think that the beauty of the story of heroines is that they use that. And in the 20th century, 21st century, they become detectives. They become writers. They're trying to navigate their way to a better world.
Harriet the Spy, Nancy Drew, both examples.
Yes, absolutely.
So I want to turn now to helping people think about what to do with what you're framing up. So I have an older sister who's coming this weekend. She's part of a book club where they don't read books. They read either articles or chapters. And I would love to give them the first chapter of this book. What is the discussion question for a group of women who want to dive into this together? What, if you were in that room, what would you tell them to talk about, or questions would you tell them to ask?
Oh, I think the first question would be, what is a hero and what is a heroine? That is, how have you thought about that over time? And how have we framed heroism way back when up to the present? And you start to realize that the concept of heroism isn't stable at all, that it changes over time. It evolves. Who were our heroes during the past 2 years? Healthcare workers, people who were taking care of us, and then the scientists who were curious and trying to find a cure for us. And that constellation of traits, I think, is just so powerful. And it reminds us that the model we have today is very different from what we had even a few centuries ago, but certainly completely different from what you find in ancient times.
So I won't have time to go to Susan in Arlington, but she wanted to point out Maleficent, the most recent versions of that, which take her from a bad guy, her backstory, to someone who is trying to defend the nature and the people around her. So we have about 60 seconds, two or three stories, maybe one from a fairy tale, one from mythology, one from a movie that people should check out, just sort of rapid fire.
Oh, start with Bluebeard, my favorite tale, which is about a husband who is a serial murderer, and his wife is a curious woman who wants to find out what is in his forbidden chamber. So she opens up the door, and if you read it, you'll find out what's in that chamber. And then I suppose for an update of that, let me invoke again Get Out, because it's a rewrite of that fairy tale. And then I think what I would recommend is Pat Barker's The Women of Troy.
Fantastic.
I have just started, and it's breathtaking.
That's Maria Tatar discussing her book, The Heroine with 1001 Faces. She is the chair of the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. There'll be more Radio Boston.